Well, I am thrilled to be back tonight. I had two classes last week, and so I knew I had plenty of time to cover what I wanted to. I have expanded my notes that I was going to use for tonight from 4 pages to 6 pages, and which means I probably will not get through tonight. But at least I've given you something that you should be able to pull a little bit from. But tonight, we're going to talk about the Jewish institutions, and we're going to talk briefly about the Tabernacle Temple, and then the priesthood, and then I want to spend probably a majority of the time on the synagogue, because I think that's probably something that most of us are interested in, at least that, and then the Sanhedrin, or the Jewish Council, and how that developed into the New Testament times. Now, to begin with, when we start talking about the tabernacle and the temple, we all know about the tabernacle as it was constructed according to the pattern that was given on the mountain, Exodus 25, verse 9, as well as Hebrews 8 and verse 5 says to Moses, make it according to the pattern shown on the mountain. And by the way, if you want an excellent sermon on the tabernacle, Brother Jason Hilburn was at Tuesday night at Leone's site. So, I listened to an excellent lesson. So if you want to, Monday night then. But it was an excellent lesson on the tabernacle. The tabernacle gave way to the temple. You know, David said it was a shame that he lived in a house while the Lord's was a tent. And so he planned it. The Lord didn't let him build it because he's a man of blood, a man of war. But it was built by Solomon, and I encourage you to read 1 Kings chapter 6. Particularly, that whole chapter is an excellent description of it. Now, I mentioned to you, I'm a visual learner, and for those of you who want to look at this, this is a drawing of what the tabernacle would have looked like. It was basically a big tent surrounded by a courtyard. There was the brazen altar in front, the laver. And then inside was the holy place, or the most holy place. Out in the desert in Israel, there is a replica of it, which is amazing. You can actually find it online if you want to and look at it. But it's amazing to see it in its what I would call natural habitat when you're in that area. Now, I will tell you, for 369 years, however, it sat on the top of Shiloh. We visited Shiloh on our trip last year, and for those of us who went, you can remember we walked up this direction. Let me get my little line here. We walked up this direction here. We went to this little place here, and then we walked down to this. In this area right here is where there is a segment that where the tabernacle would have sat, and it's amazing to think about that place. And yet what the Bible tells us about Shiloh, God tells the children of Israel to remember Shiloh because of what happened there. But that temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar in 586. That's recorded in 2 Kings chapter 25. And it was rebuilt by Zerubbabel in 516. You'll remember the children of Israel returned in 536. And in 520, Haggai and Zechariah said, basically, paraphrasing, get busy, build the temple. The Lord wants his temple built, and it was completed in 516. That's recorded in Ezra chapters 5 and 6. It was not as glorious. You'll remember the people who saw the original temple and then saw the foundation being laid, they were just crying because for them it was something not going to be nearly as glorious. The only dimensions given by it is that it was 60 cubits in height and 60 cubits wide. Now, when you compare that to what is found in 1 Kings chapter 6 and verse 2, King Solomon was 60 cubits in length, 20 in width, and 30 in height. So it was larger, but not necessarily more prominent, I guess is the best way to put it. That temple, however, though, was remodeled. And that's the term, I guess, is to use, is remodeled. Because it was not torn down, it was embellished, and I would say probably a facade put on it. But that took 46 years, according to John chapter 2 and verse 20. And when you consider some of the other things they did and how quickly they did it, that to me was very impressive. And it was completed somewhere from around 20, it started around 20 to 19 BC and not completed completely until 64 AD. Now, here is an artist's drawing of what Zerubbabel's temple might have looked like. Again, if you're talking about 60 cubits in height, 90 feet tall, that's a very tall building there. And so the front of it would have been very visible. Now, here's a map of what it would look like in Solomon's day. There's three main valleys in Jerusalem. There's the Kidron Valley on the east side. There's the Tyropian Valley, which has now been mostly filled in. And then the Hinnom Valley on the south. And right here is the Temple Mount, which is where Mount Moriah was located. Now, if you come fast forward to the time of Nehemiah around 440 BC, you'll notice Mount Zion has already taken place. That was David's. Here is the wall, the spring tower. Here is Hezekiah's tunnel. We was able to go through that this last trip as well. Then if you jump fast forward to the time of Christ, you'll notice that this Temple Mount now has grown dramatically in size. And to give you some kind of comparison, Solomon's temple, this is a picture of the size comparison compared to a football field. You see the football field on the right-hand side there. If you compare that to the temple that Herod refurbished, you can see the size comparison in it. So it was much, much larger. It would have accommodated thousands of people on that Temple Mount area. Three football fields. And, of course, that's just the temple proper. That's not counting the whole layout area. So you can see, again, this is Solomon's here, and this is Herod's temple right over here. Now, when you start thinking about Herod's temple, it's important to understand that there is two different Greek terms to refer to the temple. The word Hieron denotes this whole area here, but the word Naos refers just to the building. So if you're in the Bible sometimes and you're reading, you may not understand which one you're reading about, but the whole area is generally what is referred to. When it talks about the apostles teaching in the temple, they would not have been teaching in the building. They would have been teaching in that colonnaded area along the side, which is called Solomon's portico. And this south side was called the royal portico. And this up here is the fortress of Antonio. That's where Pilate's palace would have been, at least the pavement where he would have judged Jesus at. Now, if you get a little bit closer, you'll notice you have the courtyards of the priests. You have the women's courtyards. You have this area where the priest would have operated. And then this outer area right here would have been the court where the Gentiles would have been able to come. If you zoom in a little bit more, you have inside Solomon's temple, you have, again, the holy place right here. You have the most holy place here. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time because y'all are very familiar with that. I just wanted to give you some kind of visual of what this might have looked like. Now, one of the great things that's happened recently is, I don't know how many of you have heard the Temple Sifting Project. What the Muslims did, they decided they wanted to repave an area of that. And so they took the tiles up and they dug down. And they did a little leveling. Well, what they did, they brought backhoes up in there and they just took the dirt, carried it out and dumped it into the Kidron Valley. Well, the Israeli Antiquities Authority said, we're not going to let that just sit there. So they had a sifting project. They brought in all these archaeologists and they took the sand and sifted through it. And it's amazing. They found coins. They found little amulets. They found all these kind of things. One of the things they started finding was pieces of Solomon's portico. It might be the little rosettes and stuff. And they've been able to go back and do a very intensive study. They can even tell the color that was on it. And this is what it would look like. It would have had tiles down for your floor. It would have had these beautiful columns. And again, to give you some kind of idea, they would have been very colorful as well. They would have, the columns would have been about halfway up in a dark red color. And that's what Solomon's portico would have looked like. And again, you'll notice around up here at the top, they have found some pieces of that, which has helped them understand what it would have looked like. And again, the capitals, those are Corinthians capitals on the top there. They also have blue and gold on them, which is, you know, again, in my mind, when I look at it, I see that white stone and I don't think about the beauty of this place. But you remember when the disciples met Jesus in the end of Matthew 23, the first part of Matthew 24, and they showed him the buildings of the temple. You know, look how impressive this is. And remember what Jesus said, not one stone will be left upon another that's not thrown down. Again, the capitals there, and that's a Doric one. And this is what might would have looked like, because that temple front is 90 feet in height. You know what? That would have been an impressive sight from a distance. Again, this is a picture here of like one of the little pieces that they found. And again, like I said, they did the testing of the coloring on there to give some kind of idea of what it would look like. That's very, if you're standing on the Mount of Olives, you know, I took this picture last year when we were there. This is where the temple would have sat. This outline here, these are the walls that Herod built. Now you can say, well, that doesn't look that large, but if you can look, there's a bus right there. Can you see that bus? That's a tour bus. Some kind of perspective to give you how big that is. So again, Solomon's portico would have been on this outer edge here. This is your eastern gate right here. Now, at the Jerusalem or the Israeli Museum there in Jerusalem, there's a model of the temple, and it's really very accurate as far as size is concerned. But you can get an idea of here is where the Shushan Gate, and that would probably have been the beautiful gate right there. But this would have been the Solomon's portico. This is where I'm assuming the apostles did the majority, and Jesus did his teaching. Now, you know, when he drove out the money changers and the animals, the sheep gate's right over here on this side. So I'm guessing that they probably would have been set up in that area right over there. So it just gives you an idea. And this is actually where Gentiles could have been. And if you're looking at the south, these are the gates that go up. And there's a stairwell going in there. And again, that's just another picture. Now, for somebody to go, you may not appreciate why it took so long to build this. But this stone right here, I'm standing, taking a picture, looking at it. It's 41 feet long. It's 12 feet in height. And it's 15 foot deep in that wall. It weighs 517 metric tons. The maximum load of the largest crane you can get right now can only carry 18 tons. Now, if you look at it from the other direction, that's my son Micah right there. We stood at each end of it and took a picture of that stone. Can you imagine that one stone weighing 517 metric tons? And that lets you know those walls have been there a long time and they're not going to fall down. I mean, when it's 15 foot, you're talking about the depth of it from here to that wall over there. So it's it was three times as heavy as a house, to give you some kind of idea. Now, somebody says, well, where was the temple sitting compared to the Dome of the Rock? Well, if you're looking at this outline here, this is the building, the Dome of the Rock, that gold dome building. You can see where the temple sat. It's the red on this. And inside of that is a stone right there. And that's why they call it the Dome of the Rock. That stone's in there. And if you're taking a picture from overhead, this is what it would look like. Now, you'll see this indentation right here. That actually exactly measures the same dimensions as the Ark of the Covenant. So that gives you some kind of idea of what the stone would have been there. So that's the inside of where the most holy place would have been.
Where's Mohammed's footprint?
What's that?
Where's Mohammed's footprint?
I don't see it there.
It's supposed to be in that rock.
Well,
when he came back to earth.
I'm scared of that. Well, let me put it this way. I've been in there three times. And actually, there is a cave up under that rock, and it's called the Well of Souls. And my wife and I have been in there three times as well. And she says, let's get out of here. I don't think they want us in here. But it is amazing to see it. And you can stand right about here, and you can look and see that rock. The only thing is they would not let us take cameras in with us. But let me tell you, because this is covering the intertestamental period, the building of Herod's temple fell in that intertestamental period. But there were other temples that were built. One of them was on Mount Gerizim, which was built by the Samaritans. It was likely built by Sanballat. Now, do y'all know who Sanballat is? He was one of those who opposed the rebuilding of the walls and the temple and during the time of Nehemiah. And so what they likely did was went to Mount Gerizim because they were people of the land and they built a temple there. According to Nehemiah chapter 13 and verse 28, he married into the priestly family. He had no right to be married into the priestly family, but he did. Later, a more elaborate temple was constructed in the 2nd century B.C. John Hyrcanus leveled it in 110 B.C. And you remember John 4, verse 20, when Jesus met with the woman there at the well. She is at what today is Nablus, Shechem. And she said, our father said, this is the mountain where we ought to worship. The Jews say it's at Jerusalem. Remember what Jesus' response was? Salvation is of the Jews. Jerusalem's where it was at. But he said, the hour is coming, which neither in this mountain nor at Jerusalem will you worship the Father. So, but there were two others that are built. One of them is called the Elephantine Temple, and it was built sometime in the 6th century and destroyed in 410 B.C. At the hands of the priest of the Egyptian god. I believe it's Khnum or something like that. And then there was another one that was built during the intertestamental period. Sometime, it was recorded from somewhere around 170 to 73 at Leontopolis, which was by the Oneides. Did you cover the Oneides when you covered, but they were one of the priestly families during the Hasmonean period. And, Vespasian thought that the Jews might revolt, so he destroyed it in 73 AD. But what happened was, is they believed after Antiochus the IV desecrated the temple in Jerusalem. They went down there and they started worshiping in that one at Leontopolis. Roots of it, the foundation of it, are supposedly still there from archaeological records. Let me talk about the priesthood. I'm running out of time. I didn't even think it'd take this long. The service of the temple was to be by the Levites. That's from Deuteronomy chapter 18. And the priests were to be from Aaron, that's Hebrews 5, 4, Hebrews 7, 11. However, during the intertestamental period, the priesthood became a matter of barter. You could buy it and sell it. In fact, if you're reading the book of 2 Maccabees, chapter 4, verses 8 and following, Jason bid 950 talents of silver for the job and thought he had it. But then he found out the guy named Menelaus outbid him, and so he got the priesthood. So it was something that was treated as a commodity to be bought and sold during that period of time. Now, when you come to the New Testament, you have another kind of the fact that you have two high priests at the same time. And you remember Annas and then Caiaphas, and that's found in Luke 3, 2, and well as John 18, verse 13. In Acts 23, you have Paul appearing before the high priest, and he's told one of the servants to hit Paul, and Paul, you know, calls him a whitewashed wall, and he says, you know, do you speak to the high priest so? And he says, I didn't know he was a high priest. Well, you would tend to think, well, if Paul had received letters from the chief priest and to be able to go into the other cities, he'd know who he was. But Josephus tells us that this man was appointed by Herod of Chalcis in AD 47. He describes him as a very ruthless man who seized tithes from the threshing floors In other words, what he would do, he'd go out and find somebody, a poor little man trying to harvest his grain, and he'd take and say, okay, I want your tithes. I want it now. And he'd leave them with nothing, leave them starving to death. Josephus also describes him as a great hoarder of money. So a man of great money. Now, what I really like to talk about for a while is the synagogue. The word is a Greek term. The first part of that word is syn, S-Y-N, means, together, like you synchronize something, you get it running together. The last part of the word is ago, which is the word to go or to bring. So it literally means to bring something together, an assembly or a gathering. But if you go back and you study, the word described what people did before it described a building. And I would say that's the same thing which we have to understand with regards to the church today. Somebody says, well, I'm going to the church. What do they mean by that? I'm going to the building, going to the meeting house. But the church existed long before a building existed. And our terminology sometimes not correct. And that's the case here with synagogues. They met together long before there was a place at a building. And I think, for instance, in Acts 16, when you have Lydia and those women meeting by the riverside, what would you call that? They're Jewish women. That would have been a synagogue. That would have coming together. What's interesting is if you, and I know Kevin dealt with the Septuagint, didn't he?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the Septuagint's a Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. And the word synagogue's found 590 times in the Old Testament translation into Greek. And the term congregation, like in Exodus chapter 12, verse 3, I started going through them this afternoon. I thought, I can't spend all that time going through those. But it generally translates the congregation of Israel. And when you have the congregation, what does the word congregation mean? Assembly. That's the idea of that. The synagogues, their origin, there's really about five different possibilities. And for just a second, what I'm going to do here, if you'll just give me just a moment, look at your handout. I'm going to try to show you something on this. The first page is basically Dr. Stripling describing how he dates them. He's got type 1, type 2, type 3, and these basically relate to the ages. But if you'll look on the second page, which is your page number 2, you're on the back side. The reason why I'm doing this is because I'm afraid you may not remember everything I've got to say here. But if you'll notice, he talks about there's five different possibilities. The first one would be prior to the destruction of the first temple in response to Josiah and Hezekiah. They were saying there's a possibility while they were trying to bring about all of this, stopping the worship everywhere else and bring it to Jerusalem where it was supposed to be happening, that that's where people started meeting together in groups. There's no literary, no record of that happening. There's no archaeological evidence of that happening. I don't believe it, but I'm just telling you that's what some of the scholars suggest, and that's what he would suggest, say they would think also. The other is beginning during the Babylonian captivity. While the children of Israel were in Babylon, their temple was destroyed, and the people would have met together, and that would have been a time when they would have got together and studied the scriptures. A third option was number 3, is during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. And if you'll remember, Ezra got the children of Israel together, and just like as a good scribe, what did he do? You know, he tried to teach them the scriptures there, and so they would suggest. But there's, again, no literary, there's no archaeological evidence from that. The third, number 4, the fourth one listed there is in the 3rd century BC is the diaspora, which, you know what the word diaspora means? The scattering. And so the children of Israel were scattered in all these countries. There were some who went to Alexandria, Egypt, which is where the Septuagint was done. Now, what was taking place, if you're looking at the second column up there, there is evidence of there being synagogues in Egypt. And again, they were called mostly houses of prayer, but that they also was places of study. Number five, where there is definite evidence, is during the Hasmonean revolt. And during that period of time when the revolt of these people, in fact, there's a one at Modin we're going to look at. So what he's trying to say is those are the five areas where they were thought to be. But now I'm going to go back now to my outline here. I want to make a distinction here. Whereas the temple was a place of sacrifice, the synagogue was a place of the study of Scripture and the reading of Scripture. And you know that from the New Testament. We'll look at a couple passages here shortly. There was only one temple that was authorized by God, but there were many synagogues. And in fact, many times there would be more than one synagogue in a city. And the Bible mentions 12 cities that had synagogues. And again, if you look at that sheet, he has a list of those cities there. That's really a good handout that's available there. Now, one of the things I want to make reference to is a Theodotus inscription. And you can say, well, what's the importance of that? On the south side of the temple were the south steps where we went. You remember going those south steps there. And between there and the city of David, where we went to go through Hezekiah's tunnel, they found a cistern. And while they were digging, I believe it was about 1913, somewhere around there, and they found an inscription. I'm going to go ahead and go forward and show you. This is what the inscription looks like. They dug it up out of the ground. But here's what it says. Theodotus, son of Atenius, priest and head of the synagogue, and the Greek word there is archisynagoges, son of the head of the synagogue and grandson of the head of the synagogue, built the synagogue for the reading of the law and for the teaching of the commandments. That's the main purpose right there. I mean, you've got what is really a first century inscription, and there's belief to be from the time of King Herod, which would have been 37 BC to 4 BC. So you understand it's putting you in that intertestamental period. So the purpose of the synagogue was the reading of the law. And when Jesus is at Nazareth and he goes to the synagogue, what does he do? He reads from the law. And so for the teaching of the commandments. Now it says, as well as the guest room, the chambers, and the water fittings as an inn for those in need from abroad, and the synagogue which the fathers founded with the elders and the Simonides. What I would notice here is the fact that in this, you have the guest room, the chambers, and for people who have come from afar and you need a place to stay. You don't have hotels, so where are you going to stay? Stay at the synagogue. So that gives you a little bit of idea of that. And again, there is a picture of what that looked like. Now, let me go ahead and go a little bit further here. Here's an artist drawing what the one at Capernaum would have looked like. And I'm going to give you a little more about the one at Capernaum. And if you'll look on the right, this white building here, that's the synagogue at Capernaum. That's not the first century synagogue. Now, I know some of you are looking over here on the left and you're saying, what is that? Is that the Starship Enterprise? That's a Catholic church built over Peter's house. I never have understood why that architecture there. But if you get a little bit closer, you're looking at the synagogue from the front. These are your entrances right here as you go in. And that's a large synagogue, by the way. You get inside, and I was looking to see if you could see any of our group there. Yeah, that, there's Bill. Yeah. One of the things I want you to notice, though, is if you look around, there's the seats. The outer edge is like tonight. We're sitting in a U shape. That's the way they sat in the synagogue.
And that's why we're sitting this way. I came back from there and decided to sit this room
up. But you'd have two seats. Now, one of the things this thing does not do, it does not show the upper level. And because the roof is gone, everything else. You know where people would stand around the top? Those would be the God-fearers. That would be the worshipers there. Now, there's a little video here. I'm going to try to back up out of the way. And I'm going to have to stand up for this one. But this is us walking up to it. And you can see the fellow with the blue shirt and the cap there. But the white synagogue is from the second century or later. But you see right here, you see that black stone? That's from the synagogue of Jesus. And so that gives you some kind of idea, and it's built on top of it. So now let me go ahead and move you to the next one here. I don't know if you can hear what I just said. But again, this is the white, and you can see the black, and that was the doorway. So basically what they did, they just built the new synagogue on top of the old synagogue, which helps you understand, which to me, if you're looking at those pictures earlier, that helped you get the bigger picture, if you will, that it was probably even with the road level, but now the new one, you have to step up three or four steps to get into the new one.
That's where Jesus read. He was called that synagogue.
Well, he read at Nazareth is where they ran him out to the edge, okay. You know. But Jesus taught often in the synagogue of Capernaum.
Healed the man with the
demon. And Jairus's daughter.
Yeah.
So those are both there at that. Now let me take you to another one that's going way south. Capernaum's on the Sea of Galilee. Masada is at the end of the Dead Sea on the bottom part of it. And the reason why I wanted to do this is because it's got a really good picture here of showing what it would have looked like. Again, you see the seating there. And if you go here, you'll find somebody else sitting. again, you can see the seats also in a U shape. And if you ever notice the black line, everything below the black line was found what they call in situ. In other words, that's the way it was found. Anything above the black line has been reconstructed. Now this one is the synagogue at Magdala. And one of the reasons why I really wanted to go on this trip was because of the synagogue of Magdala. It was only uncovered in 2021. So this is how new this is. And our tour guide, that's George right there. He was a really good tour guide. I'll just tell you several things real quick here. He said, you know, this was thought to be the entrance right here. And, when they first found it, but then after they realized that's not the entrance, the actual entrance is over here on the right. This was an area for the teaching of students here. We'd call it a classroom. And in here was the area of the normal synagogue. And if you go around, one of the things that I think we sometimes tend to think that they were all so dark and they're so bland. But if you'll notice here, you'll see a fresco on the wall where the color is actually mixed into the plaster. And if you go a little bit further, you'll find they had really nice flooring. That's a mosaic floor, little old bitty small tiles and the Greek keys that are a part of that. But here is what's called the Magdala Stone. And I've tried to do a little bit more study on that. There's several things. He pointed out this is the oldest inscription anywhere in the Bible lands of the lampstand. That's the oldest they have record of. And the little rosette down there is also something that's very characteristic of seeing in synagogues. But this looks like it's about this tall. And I thought, well, it's too tall to be a seat. too short to be a podium. But they, the reading of today, they said most of the teachers sat teaching. And so it most likely was a podium for the person sitting to teach, like the table here. So that's what the, and it's very, very ornate, by the way. And I thought that
sitting there, sitting at what seat?
Moses' seat.
See, they described sitting Moses' seat. They're teaching the law. Mm-hmm. You do what they say, but not as they do. So you're sitting in Moses' seat.
I'm sitting in Tony's seat tonight. Okay, real quick now, because I hadn't even got to the Sanhedrin yet. I want to go through some of these passages. If you want to take your little phone and go take a picture of that screen. These are just some of the verses I chose with regards, I believe there's 69 references to the synagogues in the New Testament. So we're definitely not going to cover them all. But let me just hit just a few of these that I think would be very valuable for you to hear. Matthew 6 and verse 2. And I'm just going to read these real quickly here, parts of them. He says, therefore, when you do your charitable deeds, your alms, do not sound the trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues. I want you to think about that. Sounding a trumpet as you're going to do a good deed. Hey, everybody, come on. Let's show what I'm going to do here. Matthew 6 and verse 5. And when you pray, you shall not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the corners of the streets. Notice standing in the synagogues. What was the normal way that people were in the synagogue? Sitting around the edge and the teacher sitting in the middle. Well, I got to stand up so everybody knows who I am. Draw attention to myself. Matthew 10 and verse 17. Beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils and scourge you in their synagogues. You think about, this is a place where you've been reading law and they bring somebody in and they beat the tar out of him. All right. Matthew 23 verse 6. They love the best places at the feast and the best seats in the synagogues. You know where the best seats are? At the back. That's where they are in church. All right. Let's go to Mark chapter 1. There's several things in Mark 1. Verse 21. He said, and they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered their synagogue and taught. Verse 23, now there was a man in their synagogues with an unclean spirit. You made reference to that. Verse 29, as they went out of the synagogue, they entered the house of Simon and Andrew and with James and John. Immediately after go out of the synagogue, you go into the house of Peter and Andrew. So that tells you, where is it located? Right out the front door, which, by the way, is where that one is located there in Capernaum. Verse 39, and he preaching in their synagogues throughout all Galilee and casting out demons. Synagogues indicates as Jesus would go to Chorazin, he'd go to Bethsaida, he'd go to Gamla. You know, all these little cities would have their synagogues. Mark 3 verse 1, he entered their synagogue, and again, a man who had a withered hand. Mark 5 verse 22 said, and behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name, came out, and then he healed his daughter. And then you go to Luke 5, and it tells us about who built the synagogue there. It says, and he concluded all these sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum, and a certain centurion's servant who was dear to him was sick and ready to die. So when he heard about Jesus, he sent the elders and the Jews to him, pleading with him to come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they begged him earnestly, saying, that the one for whom this should be done was deserving, for he loves our nation and has built us a synagogue. A centurion paid for the building of that synagogue. And a centurion's what kind of officer? He's a Roman officer. I thought that was worthy of taking notice. John 9, verse 22, it says, his parents said these things for because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone confessed that he was the Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. You could be barred from the synagogue. And the same thing in John 12, verse 42. If you go to the book of Acts, chapter 6 and verse 9, you have the synagogue of the freedmen, which would have been slaves who have been turned free. They were Cyrenians, Alexandrians, and those from Cilicia and Asia. You go to Acts chapter 13 and verse 5, again, the plural use of it. Acts 13, 14, and 15, they went in the synagogue on the Sabbath day, and the rulers of the synagogue come to them and say, you know, if you have any word of exhortation for the people, say on. In Acts 15, verse 21, when they're having the meeting there in Jerusalem with the elders and the apostles, it says, Moses has had throughout many generations those who preach him in every city being read in the synagogues every Sabbath. And then Acts 17, verse 17, therefore he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the Gentile worshipers. And he's persuaded both Jews and Greeks, chapter 18 and verse 4. So my purpose of bringing all this up is to try to let you realize the synagogue was an important part of the plan, something that occurred during that intertestamental period. And it made a perfect transition for those who had been Jews, who had been used to gathering together to study God's Word, now to gather together and study the New Testament as well. Now, for just a second, I want to talk about the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is the Council of the 70. You know where the idea of the 70 comes from? Yep. You remember Moses and those in the book of Numbers, chapter 11 and verse 16. He said, gather me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you may know of the elders of the people and officers, and bring them to the tabernacle of meeting that they may stand there with you. So the idea of it goes back to those men who were chosen to serve. Now, I'm going so fast, I'm looking at my watch. Numbers chapter 11, verse 16. Now, if you look at Herod's temple, there is a room here on the south side called the Chamber of Hewn Stone. Now, it may not look like a very big room, but that room was big enough for more than 70 people. You remember when Jesus was taken before the council? He would have been taken in that room. So there would have been officers there. There would have been the chief priest there. And do you know who at least a couple of guys, who you know their names, are a part of that council? Nicodemus, Joseph of Arimathea, and likely Gamaliel. Yeah. So, if you look at it, guess what kind of seating they used? Just like the synagogue. And
that's how we
often. Yeah. We need where people can look at each other and be able to converse with one another. And if you'll notice, the high priest would sit in the middle, and you have 35 on this side and 35 on this side. And then you would have the person, it says student seating, but out here you would have the person standing before them. Now, in my mind, you know what immediately comes to my mind? Acts 23 and Paul. And who do you suppose that one's going to sit on? The Sadducees going to sit on one side, the Pharisees going to sit on the other side. And it's almost like throwing up a basketball and seeing who gets it first. You know, it's because of the resurrection of the dead that I'm being called into question here this day. And that's all it took. Let me just give you some verses, and then, because I got 1 minute left. Matthew 26 and verse 59. Now the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false testimony against Jesus to put him to death. This whole group of people here are out trying to find somebody to say something. Or you go to Mark 15, verse 43. Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent council member. That makes me think of like some of these people who've been elected senators or representatives, Some of them have a little more clout than others, don't they? And then if you go to Acts 5, verse 21, it says, and when they heard that, they entered the temple early in the morning and taught. But the high priest and those with him called the council together with the elders of the children of Israel and sent to prison to have them brought to them. And when they had brought them, they set them before the council. And the high priest asked them, then one of the council stood up, Pharisee named Gamaliel, teacher of the law, held in respect by all the people, and commanded them to put the apostles outside for a little while. So when they departed from the presence of the council, rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer shame for his name. You get the idea of the apostles appearing right here before them. You have any questions?
What was that first scripture, Matthew?
Probably 26, verse 59.
Mm-hmm.
10 families to form a synagogue. Yeah, that's true. I just couldn't say enter everything. I will tell you the one that I gave you there, though, that's a really, really good, and there's a picture of, like, for instance, the one there, it's on the top of Herodium. There's that picture that I showed you of the black stone. And there is the one at Gamla. And there's actually, it's called Gamla because it represents camel's back. That look like a camel's back. And then there's the pictures again from Magdala. I don't know why I'm drawing a blank there. And then again, by the way, when we left the Valley of Elah, we drove right through here. I got one picture of that. And let's see. One more. And this is another one of the pictures. But I'd encourage you, if you you can go to Bible and Spade. That's volume 33. Page 3 of that, I think it is. But it's a really good one. All right, I'm done.
Well, this completes our course on the period between the Testaments. I tell you, there is so much know about that period. And in these 13 classes, we just kind of stick the top. I mean, there's just so much you could spend forever just studying the period between the Testaments. And it's very interesting, and it gives you some insight both back into the Old Testament and forward into the New. And so that's really the purpose of studying it, is to have a good place to stand to kind of look back and see the Old and New Testament and have a better understanding of what came to this and what came afterwards. And then we're going to start getting back into the New Testament and other studies. We got 3 more classes. But that's going to be on 1 Thessalonians, 1 and 2 Thessalonians.